Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 161, I chat with Michael Fremmer about all the cool audio gear we saw and heard at The Show Newport Beach. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded June 3rd, 2013, episode 161, The Show, Newport. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and editor of AVS Forum. This week's guest geek is Michael Fremmer, the editor of Analog Planet and the person I consider the audiophile's audiophile. Hey, Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Scott. It's great to be with you once again.
Once again, you are one of my regular returning guests, and happily so, because it's always great to talk to you, and you always have great opinions about things. And this week, we're going to be talking about The Show, T-H-E, The Home Entertainment Show, which was held last weekend at the Hilton and Atrium Hotels right across the street from the Orange County John Wayne Airport. Now, they say that this was a Newport Beach, but as you were pointing out before the show started, it's really in Irvine. But Newport sounds better.
Of course it sounds better, but it has nothing to do with Newport. And you have to take a long taxi cab ride to get to Newport, where I went Thursday night after I landed to go have dinner. But there are no really good restaurants on that pier. So don't ever go to the pier for fine dining, because there is nothing
okay
there.
Good advice. Thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
Those who are logged into the live stream at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Michael as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So, Michael, before we get to the show itself, I wanted to ask you, why is it that audiophile shows like The Show that we just went to, and I was there Saturday afternoon, why are they so popular? Why are there so many of them? There's Rocky Mountain Audio Fest. There's Axpona, which happens several times a year. New York Audio Show. Munich High-End Show in Germany.
Yeah. I was there too. I was at the Munich show.
You were there as well?
Yeah. So that was the real hi-fi show. And then, of course, there's a one in Paris, and there's one in Hong Kong, and there's one in Montreal, and there's one in Chicago, and there are so many. And there's one in Russia. I mean, they're all over the world. I've been to them.
Why is this? Is there really that large an audiophile community to support all these shows?
Yes. It's much bigger than the perception of it is. And the only way to really understand that is to go to the Munich show. The Munich show is held in a convention center. It's almost like the Javits Center in New York, where they have the car show. It's a big, big building, and it's filled with tens of thousands of people. And it's where most of the industry does its business for the fall selling season, not at CES. Because the CES is right, Consumer Electronics Show is right after the Christmas buying season. It's kind of an inopportune time. And right. So most of the business in our industry is done at Munich in May. And that is an enormous show, tens of thousands of people. And if you go to my website, analogplanet.com, you can watch. I have a GoPro camera here that I walked around the show and I put on my head. And, you know, I made the sacrifice of walking around like a proctologist because I wanted people to get a Mikey eye view of what it was like to walk around the show.
And, well, that's fascinating. Is it up now?
Yeah. And I also used some of it at Newport. Unfortunately, I had it accidentally set for still photo, because I did the ribbon cutting ceremony. And I wanted people to see what it was like to be there, be me cutting the ribbon with all, you know, with John Atkinson and Robert Hawley from that other magazine, and see all the people looking at us like we were Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt taking pictures of us like we were actually almost important. And I only got one still.
Here we go. We've got on the live stream now, for those of you who are watching.
Oh, yeah, that's me.
Is some of your GoPro head-mounted video footage. Is this from THE?
Yeah, that was me. I went record shopping and I saw. And what's cool is I went away, and when I put this on YouTube, And I annotated it. So you'll see in a second. That's my friend Jacob, who actually had the bad taste to actually stick his finger in. You never do that. You don't stick your finger in front of what someone else is doing in the. See, now I put up there. See that up there?
Yep.
I have a comment.
It says LP something.
It was about this particular series of LPs, and I just said I have that, those Frank Sinatras. They're really good. So I went through it after I edited it and put it up there, and annotated it. I took a tour of the. I was in Amsterdam after Munich, and I took a tour of the record industry pressing plant in Amsterdam, and I put a bunch of that up on my site, and with the GoPro camera, and it's really cool because it's not just pictures, but it's an actual firsthand view. You know what I mean? So it was good. So yeah. That's what I've been doing, trying to be hip and, you know, I'm not skateboarding. I don't skateboard underwater. It's just.
I guess we could call this extreme sports, from, you know, extreme audiophile sports.
That's right. But I did go jogging in London. I was in London also on a secret mission. And I jogged around Kensington Park and I put that video up. And the first picture I put up when I got to the show, my first show report picture was of the empty gymnasium at the hotel at the Hilton. I love going to hi-fi shows because the gymnasium is always
the fitness totally center is empty. Always,
there's no one there. There's no one there. This is the most out of shape industry next to the insurance or the medical industry. It's, you know, it's sad.
So how is it? I mean, I do understand that. You walk around the show and you see a lot of out of shape, overweight
people.
I didn't
answer your question yet, right?
Well, the question is, how does the hobby sustain such a large following? I mean, if people are so out of shape, you know, they're going to be dropping like flies, right? I mean, how do we get young people in as the oldsters? I mean, am I correct that the audiophile hobby generally represents a somewhat older demographic?
That's changing right now. It's always been, you know, if you go back to the 70s, do you go back to the 70s? I go back to the 70s.
I certainly go back to the 70s.
I was already older.
As I say, if you remember the 60s, you weren't there.
Yeah, well, I don't remember the 60s too much, but
the 70s. 70s, we both remember. Okay.
You know, Rolling Stone was all full of hi-fi ads. That's what it was. It was, you know, big speakers and Maxell with the wind blowing in your face and turntables and Fisher and Scott and all those companies. It was all about getting a good stereo. And that generation did buy a good stereo because the music was so great that it was worth getting a good stereo. Plus, there wasn't even a Walkman at that point in time, and there were no iPods, obviously. So that generation, my generation, really became audiophiles by default. And a few generations later, it was all downloading crappy sounding files and, you know, stealing music and listening to computer speakers. And, you know, if you go online now, you'll see that there's still a whole generation of dweebs and nerds and geeks who think that if you spend more than $200 on a pair of speakers, you know, you're insane. But that's slowly but surely changing. And it's changing because when an entire generation has been cheated out of one of the great pleasures in life, which is listening to music on a fine audio system and hearing music in a way that gives you an emotional charge, not just something you hear in the background while you cook or clean or have sex or whatever else you do, which is how music's been used for the past two generations. When you've been cheated out of that, at some point, every generation rebels against what came before. And the current generation is rebelling against that nonsense. And the reason why they're rebelling is one guy's buying a turntable and hearing how good music can sound, and then his friend comes in and hears it, and it's spreading virally the same way that MP3s spread virally among a very poorly a generation that was led down the wrong path. And so kids are buying turntables. If you go to a used record stores today, or you go to like used record fairs, like the WFMU record fair here in New York in November, it's mostly kids. I mean, everybody's a kid compared to me, but it's mostly young people that are buying these records.
Wow.
And when they buy records and play them on their turntables, at one point they say, gee, I want to hear it sounding better. And then they move up to the next piece of equipment. And I know this because I get the emails now from a lot of young people. My website's populated by a lot of young people, and they're interested in, you know, buying a better turntable, buying a better amplifier, getting bigger speakers, because the little plastic computer speakers, they realize aren't really giving them much of a sound. So at this show, it was a mixed bag. The show in Munich, in Europe, this subject, music, is a far more important thing than it is in America. So in Europe, the demographic, the audience was much younger generally. And when I was in, I did a show in Warsaw a couple of years ago, and I was amazed. And in China too, apparently. I haven't been there yet. But apparently overseas, having a good stereo is a aspirational goal of a young generation. Mm. So I'm absolutely positive that this is growing, and I'm not worried about the future of this business. And really, Scott, when you go to the Munich show and you see the size of that show and the number of people that are there, it's an industry. It's not a bunch of dweebs standing around a hotel lobby going, what are we going to do? Where is everybody? There's no business. You know, and believe me, there's tens of thousands of people at this show and millions and millions of dollars of business being done. And all these companies that have been around for all these years, they're still around. So it's selling to somebody. And they are. It's not as big in America. There's no doubt about it. You know, you talk to these companies, they're surviving because of Europe and especially Asia and Russia. And it's because in those countries, music is valued. You know, if you go to Poland, you land at the Frederick Chopin Airport.
You know? Yes.
Ask most American who's chopping, they won't even know who he is. So I'm sorry to say that there's a lot of people of certain political persuasions who believe in American exceptionalism. And I agree with them. America is exceptional. It's exceptionally backward and stupid in many ways.
Ooh,
and
careful now. Let's not get into politics.
Careful. It's a fact. You know, thank God there are some kids holding the flame up and you know, that they love music and they listen to classical music, and they listen to jazz, and they listen to all kinds of music that's important to their lives. We have to get more and more people in that so that we become as exceptional as they are in China and in Germany and Poland and all over Europe where music is an important thing. And life does not consist of going, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I'm not saying there's anything wrong with, you know, or, hey, I got
typing
guitar
with your thumbs.
No, you're not. It's fine. Video games are fine. You know, my nephew's the CEO of Activision, so I have nothing bad to say about video games. It's make a good living, you know?
Yeah, 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 exactly.
But it's fine. But listening to music on a fine audio system is one of life's great pleasures. And I'm happy to say that at this show at Newport, there were many, many young people there that I ran into and that go to my website and read what I have to say and love music and have good stereos. So it's the future is very bright for our business.
Well, it sure seems that way. And certainly magazines like Stereophile and the other one, Absolute Sound, are doing very well in an era where most print magazines are suffering badly.
Right. I mean, we're doing fine. I don't know about TASS's subscription base, but we're doing fine. It's not huge. We're still a niche. It's going to be a niche. It always has been a niche. But, 80, 90, 70,000, anywhere in that range, that's pretty much what you expect for a niche publication like Stereophile, which is really about the tweakier side of things. You know, I reviewed on my website. I normally mostly do analog, but I reviewed something that was at the show, these Pioneer inexpensive speakers that Andrew Jones,
yes,
the TAT designer, designed. Yes. And I'm sure many people have heard of those speakers. Unfortunately, the numbers that the Japanese give to their products, it's the BS, which is bad to begin with, BS 22 MLP 24. I don't remember the numbers.
Right.
But you know, there are these Pioneer speakers. They're $150 a piece for a three-way floor standard. That's $300 a pair.
Yes.
And they have a bookshelf model that's like $60 or $50 a piece. And they have an amplifier for $299. And it was at the show. And
yes,
Pioneer did a really smart thing. They put it next door to Andrew Jones's big exhibit with the $80,000 TAD speakers, you know, with the $60,000 preamp and the $50,000, $80,000 amplifier. And right next door with the little speakers was this little system that cost $400. And guess what? It sounded great. Did it sound as good as the big system? No, but it sounded really, really good.
Well beyond its price class. I agree with you. I've heard them myself. Unfortunately, when I walked by that room when I was at the show, it was closed for lunch and they said, we'll be back soon. And I didn't get a chance to go back. But I've heard those speakers anyway, and I've recommended them all the time to people who are on a budget. You know, you're just going to get great value for your money.
I bought a whole set for my second home theater.
And there you go.
And actually, the center channel speaker is amazingly good. You know, that's the hardest thing, is to get that center channel right, so it does voices with clarity and believability. And that $50 center channel. But Scott, guess what? When I did that review, you know, I take a lot of, I won't use the word, for reviewing expensive equipment, you know? I reviewed expensive equipment. Guess what? I got the same, I'm not going to say what the word is.
You
the
know
same.
What? Yeah.
I say what the word is. Oh, how dare you review inexpensive? Oh, he's lowering himself to our level. He dares to come down to our, you know, it's just so ridiculous. Yeah.
Damned if you do and damned if you don't. But all you can do is do what you do. And I think you do it great. Lawn Dog in the chat room has a question. Those are old and used records we were seeing on that video a little while ago. And he finds that they are very hard to clean without potentially causing damage. What is your procedure for cleaning old records, old LPs, vinyl LPs?
Records are not that difficult to clean. It depends how much you want to invest in cleaning records. You can get, there are two reasonably priced cleaning machines that cost under $100. One is the Spin Clean, which works very, very well, but it's all manual. And it includes a vat. You pour this fluid in it. You put the record in the vat. It sits halfway in the vat. And then you spin it around by hand for a while. Then you take it out and you wipe it off and let it dry in a sink. It does a very good job. And then there's the Jim Dandy, I think it is, which is Merrill's piece that I reviewed a couple of years ago, that hooks up to a garden hose, and you hook the record up to it and you spray the record and spin it around and then let it dry. Very similar kind of thing, but it's a little messier. And those will work fine. You could spend from that up until $5,000 for a record cleaning machine.
I remember when in the old days, I had the Discmaster, that sort of wooden thing with a velvet.
Disc washer.
Is that still available? Did that work at all, or was I being foolish?
It's better than nothing, but it really doesn't work all that well. Mostly what it does is squash the dirt back into the record. And if you're watching, Mr. Disc Washer, I'm sorry, but that's about how it. You know what it's good for? It's good for after you've cleaned a record, just to get the last bit of dust off. That's what it has a use for. Although I prefer a dry carbon brush for that purpose.
Okay.
But used record buying is some of the most fun. I'm addicted to that. Just going to find used records, going to garage sales. I should stop, but I can't stop. You know, you always find, if you watch that video that you were showing, you always find stuff that you've never, like there was one, it was a game, a horse racing game with a record attached to it. I opened the thing. I've never seen that in my life, and I've seen a lot of records, and there it was. I mean, all kinds of cool stuff was in that pile.
And that's one of the things. Actually, that's one of the things about THE and the show and all these other shows is that there are almost always vendors of LPs and also CDs, probably, and SACDs.
What are those? CDs? Is that certificates of deposit?
I mean, MA recordings, reference recordings. There are some companies that still produce CDs, aren't there?
Yes, and those companies have now gotten into vinyl. Of course, there's. I'm just pulling your legs, Scott, all the way.
Just joshing me. Yeah, I know.
From
3,000 miles away, I know.
There were fewer record vendors this year than last year.
Really?
In fact, if you want to talk about the overall gestalt of this show. Bob Levy will kill me, who's the head of the L.A. Orange County Audiophile Society. I felt, for some reason, this year's show was a little bit off from last year's show was very exciting. This year's show is a bit off. I don't think the attendance was quite as robust. And I don't know, it didn't, you know, shows are funny. It's kind of like if you go to a Broadway show and the people that act out the show, they put in the show on every night. And some shows have a magical quality and some shows just fall flat, you know? Mm-hmm. It's not because they're not great actors and it's not because they didn't put on a good show. This year's show just didn't strike me as being quite as exciting. There wasn't as much energy, which is surprising because California's economy is back. Those liberal Democrats that run it kind of balance the budget and end up with a surplus. So you'd think more people would be out there seeing what's happening in the audio world. I just felt it was not quite as well attended and not quite as exciting. Although some people had a different opinion. Some people in the room said the rooms were very well attended and that the people that attended were actually very well qualified to buy. You don't worry about Friday because that's a work day. And if people, a lot of people show up that day, those are the unemployed. So it doesn't really matter.
Right. Friday. But there was Saturday or Sunday as well.
It's unemployed or journalists, which is pretty much the same thing.
Exactly. Sure, in the chat room is asking about your stylus cleaning issues. This doesn't have to do with the show, but I'll pass it along anyway.
Yes.
What stylus cleaning issues have you had, and what are you doing about them?
Scott, I believe in complete transparency, and if I screw up, I am perfectly happy to share that with people because I don't try to put myself as being some, you know what a phrase I hate? Golden ear. He's a golden ear. I am not a golden ear. Nobody is a golden ear, and I just wish people would stop using that expression. It's a lot of bunk. What happened is, you know, I'm busy here working and I'm playing a lot of records and switching back and forth and doing what my job entails. And I thought I was keeping my stylus clean. And then one day, I forgot the exact reason why I did this, but I just put my digital microscope on my Lyra Atlas to see what was going on. It may have been that it wasn't sounding as good as I remembered it sounding, but I put the microscope on it and I was shocked and appalled by what I saw. I mean, my stylus was filthy. It was like a fur ball with hair on it, with fibers. I mean, it looked like a couch. It was, and you know what? I could have just cleaned it and moved on, but I said, I'm going to show people what happened. And I did. And, you know, I haven't had a chance to answer all the comments yet, but there's a lot of nasty comments, apparently. Mm-hmm. Someone else told me. The point is, the value of the microscope is there are many values to the microscope, both in setup and finally, at some point, just taking a close look at the cleanliness of your stylus, as I found out. So that's another reason to get one of those microscopes. But it also made me realize you have to keep that stylus clean. And I was using... Lyra recommends their SPT fluid, which is fluid with a little kind of soft bristle brush. And I was using that. But really, even though I keep my records clean, it's obvious that every once in a while, you've got to do a more robust job of cleaning the stylus with one of those stiff bristle brushes.
Mm-hmm.
Or one of those I keep forgetting the name of this thing. It's a mound of goo. It's a green box with a mound of goo. And you just drop the stylus in the mound of goo and it cleans it. It's important to use a variety of cleansing techniques on a regular basis and also to pay close attention to the stylus, not just from a normal, you know, vantage point of your eye, because your eye really can't see what's going on.
It's a very small thing, that stylus.
Yes. And one of the reasons why the stylus does get fouled up, and people should know, never pick up a record by the edge, like pinch it. Never pinch a record by the edge. I do some of that on the video where I'm going record shopping, but I know I'm going to clean the record afterwards and never do that again. If you pinch the record on the end, your fingers have oil on them. I don't care how much you wash your hands, there's oil. And so you've now deposited oil onto the outer grooves of the record. So you lower the stylus onto the outer leading grooves, and the oil immediately gets picked up by the stylus, and the stylus goes through the groove, and inevitably there's going to be some dirt on it. I don't care how clean you make the record. Dirt will settle on the record. So the dirt gets on that oil. Of course, the oil is going to hold all the dirt. And then the heat builds up on that stylus because a lot of energy is in there and a lot of heat builds up. And then suddenly the oil and the dirt and the heat harden onto that stylus tip and literally change the shape of it. And by the time it gets to the end of the record, the stylus can be a different shape than you would like it to be. And that's kind of probably what happened to me. And that's why it wasn't sounding as good as it should sound. And that causes the stylus to wear faster and the records to wear faster. So stylus hygiene is very important. And right now your home theater viewers are saying, I really couldn't care about this.
Well, I take a very broad view of home theater on this show, you know, because I suppose it should be home entertainment geeks, because I do like to talk about audio as well as video and movies and stuff. Two-channel audio, as we have talked about already, is actually very big business, and a lot of people are into it, so I count it as fair game for this show.
Right, and I'm into home theater. I review home theater for Home Theater Magazine, and, you know, I've got a nice front projector. I'm not – I know some people say, I don't have a television at home. Well, then you're stupid.
No, I wouldn't say that they're stupid. I'd say, hey, I know you wouldn't, but I would. Well, I'll let you do it then. You know, if people don't like television, fine, don't have a television. But, you know, the importance of media, of music and or video in our lives, I think is very important in terms of escape and entertainment and everything like that. So your points about, you know, listening to music on a high quality playback system are very well taken. I think I've heard a lot of people talk about, and I've talked to them about how the younger generation, as we were talking about earlier, you know, may not even have been exposed to good quality audio. They're listening to iPods with 128 kilobit MP3s and these cheesy earbuds, and they don't know any different. So the question really is, how do we educate them to understand the value of listening to music on a higher quality system?
Scott, do you have kids? You ever tried to educate your child about anything and have them listen to you? I mean, I don't have any kids, but I'm asking you.
Well, I don't have any kids either, so I can't answer that question.
I can just tell you, you know, from my friend's experience, because they tell me, they fill me in on this. Kids have to discover things on their own. You know, that's, you can't, like a lot, I know a lot of people have very good stereos and they try to get their kid involved in it and they bring the kid in and the kid that wants nothing to do with it. But at one point, all of a sudden, you know, they'll come in and say, Dad, can I hear... You know, can I hear a record? And you know why? Because their friends have informed them. It only works peer to peer. And that's why for a generation, there was only regress, no progress in this subject. And everybody I know who has kids who had really good stereos and records, and, you know, they would try to get the kids into it, and it never worked. It's got to be the kid coming to them. And the reason why it's working now is because the same way MP3s spread virally, you know, peer to peer, you know, one friend, hey, guess what? You can go on, you know, you got a T1 account at college. You can download music for free. Wow, it's cool. You know, that spread virally. And now what we're talking about is spreading virally among young people without us having to, you know, try to browbeat them into it, because that doesn't work. Mm. They're discovering it. They're discovering the value of, well, I have a favorite artist and he's put out a record. And it's got really cool artwork on the cover. And it's got, if I want to download the file to put on my iPod, it's got that too. And it's got six songs on one side they want me to hear and six songs on the other side. And it tells a story and there's an insert and, you know, and they like that. Who wouldn't like it? You know, when CDs came out and they said, well, you can get rid of, let me just find one of these things. You can get rid of this. Who wants this? You know, when you can have, I don't even have a, you know, something that comes in something like this, you know?
Yeah.
It's, to me, that was absolute insanity. I couldn't understand why anybody thought that plastic jewel box with a paper insert stapled together was something that was an object of desire, that was something you'd want to own. Why would anybody want to own something like that? I mean, and now we're seeing that to be true, because nobody wants to have CDs. Very few people want CDs anymore. They'll download music, which makes sense for digital music, and then they buy records for things they really want to cherish. CDs are just not a...
It's true. It's true. I in the little bit I walked around the show this weekend, I don't think I heard anyone playing CDs. A lot of people were playing downloaded or digitally acquired music from, like, the Blue Smoke server, J River, things like that from a computer. And that's what most of the people I heard, most of the rooms I heard music in, that's what they were using.
The irony is you can transport CDs a lot more easily than you can records. I mean, you could stick 100 CDs in one of those little, you know, fold up cases, which is what people used to do before it was easy, you know, to download and play files where we can now. So, but even that people don't want to bother with, because why bother when you can have it, you know, on an iPod or an iPad, you know, or on a Mac Mini. Yeah. On the other hand, people were schlepping big boxes of records, you know? I mean, it's not done for convenience. It's done because the people that schlep the records love the records, and they want the people coming into their room to hear their equipment on vinyl, even if they don't make turntables, even if they don't sell turntables, just because they think that's the best way to listen to music. And yeah. Can I tell you something else? Because
please.
I went to this event a couple of months ago at Del Posto restaurant. You ever heard of that restaurant?
It's one of
Mario Batali's restaurants in New York. It's a 4-star Italian restaurant. And
in New York?
In New York. The manager is an audiophile. And he said, you know, I'm running an event here at Del Posto in the basement with the sponsored by the Austrian Trade Council. And they're going to have an evening of live music, Austrian wine, and Austrian Italian cuisine. And could you promote it on your website? Would you just do us a favor? And I was more than happy to do it. I got nothing out of it. And I promoted it. And 2 days before the event happened, they had a couple of extra seats. And he called me and said, would you like to go? So, of course, I wanted to go. I wasn't going to pay the $425 a person. Don't have that kind of money. I mean, I'll buy a cable that costs a couple thousand dollars. But let's get realistic. After you buy the cable, you can listen to it. After you eat that meal, guess where it goes, okay?
Yes. Well, leave some people to think listener's that, imagination.
Some people think that buying the cable is the equivalent of that. But that's another story.
Yes, that's another story.
So I went, and it was a really great event. I mean, there was a string quartet made up of members of the Vienna Philharmonic. They had played Carnegie Hall the night before. And The music was paired to the wine that was paired to the food each course. And they had an empty seat at each table. And so after the string quartet performed, a member of the string quartet would sit down at your table and talk to you about music.
Wow. Which I thought
was really cool. So the guy that was doing the hosting, the announcing, was an Australian guy, because the other guys were, you know, Viennese, and they didn't speak good English. So the Australian guy was doing the announcing. And he sat down and he said, so, mate, what brings you here? You know, what brings you here? I'm just curious, what brings you here? And I said, actually, I was invited by the manager of the restaurant. I write about hi-fi equipment. He said, I've got a good hi-fi. And he mentioned his hi-fi, and it was a pretty good hi-fi. And I said to him, so you're a musician. Let me ask you a question. What do you like to listen to music on, vinyl or CDs? And I say this because you always get these idiots online saying, well, I'm a musician and you're not, and CDs are perfect. And, you know, I hate those kinds of people. So I said to him, I have a lot of hate. So I said to this guy, I said, so what do you like to listen to music? And he says, well, I'm a vinyl guy. In fact, half the members of the string section are vinyl guys, because it's the violins. You can't get that right on a CD. CDs don't get string tone right. I was so happy to hear that.
Well, that's a whole nother area of discussion.
Yes, and he wasn't saying that to be nice to me, I guarantee you.
Yeah, well, I mean, musicians as audiophiles. You know, I myself am a professional musician, performing musician, and I go to a lot of live concerts. I play in them, and I go attend them and listen to them.
I didn't know that about you. You're so modest. I didn't know that. You've never mentioned that.
Well, I have from time to time. Perhaps
okay,
not
then I
you,
listen, which is also possible. What do you play?
I play mostly the low brasses: tuba, trombone, euphonium, and so you know, I play a lot within musical ensembles. And I have found for myself, and I'm only talking about myself here, that no matter how much no matter what music system I listen to, be it, you know, the hundreds of dollars Andrew Jones, or the many thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars of TAD or whatever, you know, obviously I can hear the difference, and I've been in plenty of recording studios and hear the difference.
Right.
But I'm not sure but I have never been felt compelled to spend a ton of money on an audio reproduction system, because they never get to the point that equals a live performance.
No, but the good ones can make you feel kind of, you know, you can create the illusion, or they can make you feel, you know, let's face it, you watch Angelina Jolie, you're not getting her. But if you watch her in a movie and you're close enough to the screen and you're attracted to her and she's kissing somebody, you can, you can
vicariously enjoy that.
much more easily on a big screen where you can see textures and faces and skin than you can on a little iPad or something.
Yeah, exactly.
This conversation is drifting afield. But so were you a fan of the French horn player Dennis Brain?
Oh, a very big fan.
Yes, I love
Fantastic.
That name. He played French horn. He must have blown his brains out.
Oh, yes. I've heard recordings on vinyl of him, and
yes.
And remarkable. Just remarkable. So listen, let's get...
Okay.
Sorry. You might have it there in your collection.
Yes, right behind me, actually.
There you go.
Okay.
Let's get back to the show. I'd love to hear your impressions of some of the things that you heard at the show. What stood out for you?
Well, the first thing that stood out to me is the rooms there, the hotel rooms are very difficult at that show. There are not a lot of great rooms at that show.
That's going to be true of any of these shows, because most of them are held in hotels, and people set up these hotel rooms, which are not acoustically ideal. Some of them were treated. In the MBL room, for example, he had a really strange glass acoustic treatments that I thought were kind of strange.
And that room, Jeremy Bryan is one of the better setup guys in the industry, as far as I'm concerned. And I thought the sound in New York that he got it was a 5.1 channel system, was among the best at the show. And he always gets great sound. But at this show, the sound was horrible in that room. It was soggy. I have to say,
I agree. I have to agree that in every other instance I've heard, MBL is a very high end maker, based in Germany, I think, or Switzerland.
Germany.
No. And the guy who designs his speakers, Jürgen Ries, is an amazing guy. He's a recording engineer as well as a speaker designer.
He does it all, and he's a brilliant guy. Yep.
A brilliant guy. I'm still working on trying to get him as a guest on the podcast, and one day I hope to do that.
He's going to humiliate himself like I am, but that's another story. but you're right.
But anyway, normally the MBL room sounds fantastic, and I agree with you. At this particular show, it didn't.
It was just soggy and dense, and you know why? That room was particularly difficult because it had formerly been two separate rooms, and they broke down the wall and made it one room, and there were these two cavities behind this, in front of the speakers, that were like where the bathrooms were, so there were these huge cavities that the sound was floating in and out of, and no matter what Jeremy did, it just sounded like a soggy mess. That was the case in many rooms, but what was interesting to me, the best sound that I heard, and it was strange, was in one of the big ballrooms on the first floor, and it was a brand of electronics called AVN that I never heard of, from Germany.
Yeah, I've never heard of it either.
They've been around since the 80s, apparently. And it was a brand of speakers. It used to be Isophon, and the guy changed the name for one reason or other. And now it's called Gradnir. I don't remember. I haven't looked at my notes since I come back. But I sat down there on Saturday late in the afternoon. Usually by then, I'm burnt out, and I don't want to sit and listen to too much. Plus, it was one of these big ballrooms where they had four systems set up in the room, like on each corner, and they would switch the chairs and go around and around, and those rooms tend to never sound good. And yet they produced sound in this room that kept, I had a whole CD from vinyl. I played almost the whole CD.
From vinyl, meaning you had copied vinyl onto CD?
Yeah. And when it was over, they said, that was the best sound we've gotten all day. And that's what always happens. It never fails.
Wow. I'm sorry. I missed that room.
He uses the ceramic drivers for the mid-range and the woofers, and he has a little diamond tweeter on top. And I'm not usually a big fan of the diamond tweeters because while it's a sexy thing to think of a diamond tweeter, and they're very, very stiff, which is good. They also tend to be higher in mass, so they don't move as quickly as some other designs. But this one was both fast and clean. And I played this CD that I'd made, one cut I'd recorded from a Bob Dylan live at Newport, not Newport Beach, but Newport, Rhode Island, from the early 60s. It was the finale of the show. It was Blowing in the Wind with Peter, Paul, and Mary and all these other, and Joan Baez, and this big giant spread. And the engineer probably used two microphones to get this whole spread. And so it had this enormous soundstage, this tremendous width, and it almost felt like you were outdoors. And a good system will do that in a good space. And this system, because it was in such a big space, that happened to work. And it was absolutely mesmerizing. It was fantastic. That was some of the best sound of the show.
Wow. Okay. I'm sorry I missed that. Lawn Dog in the chat room is asking, for the most part, aren't great speaker systems supposed to cover a lot of deficiencies in a room?
No, it's really actually the opposite. The bigger the speaker, the more full range the speaker, the more it's going to produce the frequencies that really are problematic in a room. The problem with all of these rooms is not in the upper frequencies as much as in the lower frequencies. You can put up a mattress on the sidewalls. You can put a picture up. You can do things to limit the reflections in any size room and produce decent high frequencies. But the bass resonances in these rooms they all had a bass resonance at around 500 hertz or 1,000 hertz, this big, like if you stop the music, you hear wow, 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 it would go yeah. on for a long time. And those are annoying colorations that no matter what you do, you simply, you almost can't get rid of them unless you play a speaker that doesn't have any low frequency that don't excite the room. So now I own big Wilson speakers. I'm a big fan of Wilson speakers. And the Alexias are a great speaker. It's one of the newest designs. And Peter McGrath, who does the setup for Wilson, is one of the best setup guys there is. And he always gets good sound. And he got decent sound at this show, but not great sound. And that's because there was a resonance in that room that he could not control. So when he was playing material that had a lot of low frequencies, it just tended to catch that resonance and it just vibrated throughout the whole performance. But then he played a piano piece that he had recorded where none of the notes, just because of how the composition was done, none of the notes excited that resonance. And it sounded fantastic. It showed how good that speaker can be. But that was the problem in a lot of rooms. It just excited resonances. YG has great speakers. And it was YG speakers and Tenor Electronics. And that room usually sounds great. But in this year, it just had this hard kind of quality that I sat through an entire CD from vinyl because it had very high decibel levels, but because it sounded good despite the problem, I could listen past it. But the big problem with these shows is if you walk into a room and the sound is bad and the guy goes, look, I got a bad room, I'm sorry, and you'll have to listen through this resonance, that's fine. But when you go in the room and they go, oh, I'm getting great sound now, and it's not great sound, then they destroy their ability with anybody who knows what they're doing.
Right. But what about acoustic treatments, though? I mean, bass traps and, you know, I know these are hotel rooms. They can't permanently install stuff, but they should be able to put up corner traps and other things that could improve the situation, couldn't they?
Bass traps are only so effective at certain frequencies and at the upper bass frequencies. It's very difficult to control those resonances. You know, there are some guys that know how to get the speaker out of the room by putting them in a certain place and making you sit very close to the speaker. But that's kind of impractical in a show when there's a lot of people coming in and out of the room. It just doesn't work. But, you know, you had asked at the beginning, and I never answered, why these shows are popular.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons is, that, you know, unfortunately, the dealer base has been shrinking, you know.
Tremendously.
Yeah, and part of that's the internet. But, of course, that means you're buying stuff without being able to hear it first. So here's an opportunity to go to one venue, one space, and hear dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of pieces of audio gear in hotel rooms. And even though the rooms have problems, you can still get an idea of what might appeal to you in a better sounding room. It's a tremendous opportunity in 1 or 2 days to, you know, have a concentrated field of great audio gear from the best manufacturers.
Well, that's really an excellent point.
Yeah.
That the specialty dealer, the audiophile dealer, is fast disappearing, becoming an extinct breed in favor of a few big box stores, but more to the point, the internet. But you're right entirely. You can't audition it before you try it. And even though I recommend to people go read reviews from reputable reviewers such as yourself, and that will give you some good idea, the best way to choose what you like, because it's so subjective, is to hear it for yourself. And your point is extremely well taken, and I don't know why I hadn't thought of it before. These shows provide an excellent opportunity to go do exactly that.
Ironically, in Munich at this big convention center, the first year they used to have it in a hotel in Frankfurt, and they moved it to this big convention center. And I said, boy, this is going to make it terrible. It's going to be a big convention center. How are they going to possibly, you know, get sound?
That's a great question. I was going to ask you that same question.
This convention center has a combination of big floor space, you know, a couple of big giant rooms that people do static displays. And upstairs, they have rooms, decent sized rooms that actually have very, very good sound, better than most of the hotel rooms. So you can do everything at the Munich show. You can hear great sound and hear big systems sounding really, really good. And you can see all the stuff on the floor. So they did a good job there in finding a venue that works for everything.
Go ahead.
Sorry. So this show, there was some good sound. I thought, you know, the TAD room sounded good. The Magico room with the smaller, with the $12,000 speakers driven by Constellation amps sounded good. I mean, all these rooms sounded good in the context of having heard them sound really good. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As opposed to what they sounded like at these shows. They sounded okay at the show. But you could get an idea of whether something appealed to you.
Yeah, exactly.
The character of the speakers or the amplifiers would come out.
Subaru in the chat room is asking a question that isn't related to the show, but you're the man to answer it if anybody can. And that
no,
is,
I'm married.
Sorry, you're married. No. Can you recommend a $500 turntable?
Yeah, that's pretty easy, actually. I would say for $400, the Project Carbon, Debut Carbon, is the easiest table to recommend at this point. You know, what's happened with the turntables is they become so popular. Project is selling so many turntables. I have the number, but I can't reveal it because I promised to keep it private. I'm in the middle of a project trying to get to the truth of how many turntables are sold and how many records are being sold, because the numbers being reported are so ridiculously underreported. It's ridiculous.
Really? Why is that, do you suppose?
Because the people doing the reporting don't bother to get into the nooks and crannies of what's really happening. You know, the RIAA and some of these other companies, they don't know what's going on. And they're reporting, you know, SoundScan, Nielsen SoundScan reports on record sales. They don't know what's going on, because I know what's happening at the pressing plants. The pressing plants aren't pressing records for their health. They're pressing records to sell. And the number of records being pressed is enormous compared to the number of records being reported sold. So I'm in this project now with a couple of people that I can't mention, and I'm trying to get manufacturers to divulge to me how many turntables they're selling. I promise I'm not going to divulge the individual numbers to anybody. But when I get them all together in a solid number, I'm going to say, here's how many turntables have been reported to me in the aggregate as having been sold last year.
Mm. And I think we saw just a moment. Well, I'll be very interested to hear those numbers. We saw a moment ago, engineer John here showed us a picture of the project turntable.
Yeah.
That you were mentioning.
Is that the Carbon or is that the Debut 3? I can't see from the picture.
I can't either.
That might be a Debut 3, which is the previous generation. So the point I was trying to make is that turntable sales have grown so much that a company like Project can afford to invest money and make the turntable better than ever and keep the price the same. So the Carbon is such an improved turntable over previous iterations of what they could sell for $399 that it's easy to recommend it.
And this one is how much again?
That's it. It's $399, I believe, but maybe more in colors, maybe a little bit more. And it comes with a decent cartridge, and the arm is so accomplished that you could eventually change to a better cartridge and, you know, improve the sound dramatically.
But you'd keep the arm the way it is.
Yeah, the arm's fine.
Yeah, well, incredible.
You don't want to, that table is sold as a unit. It's the table and the arm ready to go.
I see.
You can upgrade the platter, and the platter upgrade can make a significant improvement. But it's a great table.
So, okay, that answers the question. Thanks. Getting back to the show, I didn't hear too much. I was only there for a few hours. I did hear the TADs, and that was probably my favorite sound at the show. I mean, it wasn't perfect because, as you say, the room was a bit problematic. But
little thick sounding compared to what that speaker can sound like.
Yeah, exactly. But that speaker is $80,000 a pair. It's the R1 reference speakers.
Right.
And it was being driven by $130,000 worth of electronics.
Yeah.
Now,
and
they
don't make that stuff because no one's buying it. People are buying it, believe it or not.
They must. They must.
They are.
Probably the most expensive thing I heard, which undoubtedly wasn't the most expensive thing at the show, was in the Perfect 8 BA Labo room. Perfect 8 is a Swedish company, I think.
Glass speaker.
A speaker made out of glass. Yes.
Yes. Those speakers always sound great, and they sounded less than great in that room compared to how they've sounded at other shows too. Those things are fantastic sounding, I think.
Yeah. And these were $115,000 a pair, and they aren't even the top of the line.
Right.
They were their mid-range speakers.
They're so transparent. Looking,
but it's just
literally looking.
Being driven by almost $200,000 worth of electronics,
right,
including fire hose sized power cables, which I found kind of interesting.
Oh, speaking of cables, can I tell you one thing?
Oh yeah, please.
At the show, the Vandersteen room with the did you see the AJ Conti brought his work of art, $150,000 turntable to the show for the first time?
No, I didn't.
Yeah,
was that in the Vandersteen room?
Yeah, Vandersteen work of art, audio research, and the Vandersteen speaker sounded good in that room because that room always sounds good. But then Saturday night, I got invited with a bunch of other people to AudioQuest, the cable company.
Right.
Which is located literally 5 minutes away from the
right.
hotel.
Right.
And they had a pair of Vandersteens set up there that sounded much better than the show because their room was much better, you know. And Vandersteen himself was there and said, "Yeah, I wish this room was where I could be just, you know, showing my speakers at to the public." But then they gave us a demonstration of Ethernet cables.
Ethernet cables.
Yes.
Oh, come on.
Okay.
That can't possibly make any difference to the sound quality.
Yes, it does. So here's what they did. First, they streamed the music wirelessly, okay, from an Airport Express.
All right.
And that sounded just terrible. I mean, it was awful.
Streaming then, from some online source.
It was AirPlay or I don't know what it was, but it was from an Airport Express and a server, you know.
Okay, it was a server.
Yeah. And then they plugged in a Ethernet cable from Costco or something, you know, like a regular
old $5 Ethernet cable.
Of course, it sounded way better. I mean, I can tell you that streaming music at this point in time is not ready for any serious listening sessions. The bass was an amorphous blob, you know, streamed wirelessly. And once it went through the cable, it took on a solidity and a clarity and a rhythmic, you know, sense of purpose that was just, it was just no comparison. And the vocals, it lost the sibilant edge and a watery kind of quality. Then they switched it out to their next step up Ethernet cable. And it was definitely better. And I know they're people saying, well, this is psychoacoustics. And, you know, if I changed the faceplate on your preamp, you'd say if from gold to silver, you'd say the sound got more silvery. Okay, I understand all that. I've been through this for 25 years. I understand that that can happen. I understand that, you know, I can tell you to change the EQ a little bit and you could reach over it to the equalization switch and not change it at all, but make believe you're turning the knob and I'll go, oh, that's better. I know that that can happen. I understand.
It's called expectation bias.
Yeah, there's all kinds of biases. But, you know, the bottom line is we survived because we heard the twig breaking behind us, not because we imagined we heard it.
Right.
You know. So there's a combination of our superior abilities and the fact that the brain can't be fooled. I'm aware of that. But it definitely was better. And then they switched to their even more expensive Ethernet cable that had these insane connectors from Germany, these beautiful chrome-plated, you know, when you look at them, they really were beautiful. Whether they made a difference or not, they were beautiful. And I can't say I heard a difference there I would say I could reliably detect. But no doubt from the Costco cable to their first tier. And, you know, they're making this cable not because it's important now, but once everything is going to be streamed over Ethernet cable within a home, once audio and video ends up being streamed that way, which, you know, for serious listening, which it will be, you'll want to future-proof your house if you care about sound quality by having this kind of cable in there.
Hmm.
That's their supposition anyway.
Right. Right. Okay, where was I going to go? Oh, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, did you hear the Emerald Physics speakers?
I don't recall that. Where were they?
They were on the fourth floor, I think. Emerald Physics is very interesting because they are open baffle speakers. They basically put their drivers in a flat piece of something, wood or carbon fiber, I don't know what. But they're not enclosed in any enclosure. There's no box. They're open to the back as much as to the front.
Yeah, I've heard other speakers like that, some other brands.
Yeah, called Infinite Baffle or Open Baffle designs. I have always thought they sounded quite good. I've heard them in people's homes, actually, and was quite impressed. And I was pretty impressed here, too. Those were only $6,000 a pair, which, you know, is a lot to a lot of people, but compared to these $80,000, $100,000 a pair speakers, quite a bargain. And I thought they sounded pretty good. So if you didn't hear them, no one could hear everything, I think, at this show.
So It is impossible. I'm trying to find pictures of things that I saw that'll help me to remember, because I can't remember. There's a brand of, oh, you know, I heard the Janssen speakers, you know, remember Janssen electrostatic speakers, if you're old enough for a certain age.
Yep.
So Janssen was the inventor of electrostatic speakers, actually.
Oh.
And son is gotten back into the business and is marketing a speaker that uses the Janssen from 500 hertz up, and then it's got a pair of woofers to go the rest of the way down. And right. They're about 7,000 pairs. Those sounded pretty good to me. And I'm happy to see him carrying on his father's work.
Yeah.
And then there was a speaker called Prana Fidelity. And this is a small company. I've always, you know, we can't review them in Stereophile because they don't have five. He doesn't have five dealers. And I guess he sells them directly. But
is that a Stereophile criterion? You have to have at least five dealers in order to.
They want five dealers. They want. You know, they really don't.
They want to be able to review. They want to be able to review things that people can actually go find and buy.
Right, and that by having five deals, it means they're an established company that's not going to disappear in 6 months.
Got it.
In my column, and the columnists have greater leeway. Columnists can write about whatever they want, but full formal reviews, it needs that. So this guy, he's obviously one of these guys who's a talented designer and probably not a great businessman. He doesn't know how to grow his brand, but. This Prana Fidelity speaker, it's a two-way or three-way speaker on a stand mount, and they're about $4,000 a pair, which, again, I'm not saying this is inexpensive, but in this world, it's not.
In the scheme of things, yeah.
It's not that expensive. And they sound absolutely wonderful, as do Jeff Joseph's Pulsars that are $8,000, and that's a two-way stand mount. Those are I reviewed those. And when I reviewed them, you know, I was taking out of the system a pair of speakers that cost $200,000 and putting in a pair that were $8,000 and like a dwarf thing compared to the big speakers. And I always felt I'd put them in and, you know, do the review as quickly as I can and get them back out because I want to hear the big speakers.
Right.
But these speakers actually were completely satisfying. They're just, they don't go that low, but they give you the impression they're going that low and they don't do it at the expense of muddying up the mid-range and, you know, and reducing clarity. And that's the real talent in speaker design, to be able to produce the illusion of going lower than you really can go and not leaving a residue that you're always hearing that makes you not enjoy listening to music.
Mm-hmm. Weeb in the chat room is asking, best pair of speakers under $1,000.
I'm not really good at doing that. You know, I mean, the $150 a piece Pioneers are fantastic.
Yeah.
They have no business sounding as good as they do for $300 a pair, or even less if you buy them online or at certain places. But I'm not good at off the top of my head giving you an answer.
What would you say? And this is very subjective.
There's a pair of Kefs that are $1,500. They're about this. They're about a foot high, and they have that gold colored Uni-Q speaker.
Right.
And those are amazingly good. I heard those in a few places that it's a little more than you want to spend. But I'd go listen to those.
You can stretch it to $1,500. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
What was the model of those? Do you remember?
It was on the cover of Stereophile, but I don't remember the number. I'm not good at that. You know, if you say, what are your 10 favorite records? I couldn't begin to do that. It's just not I'm good at.
I understand. Actually, somebody at the show asked me what my favorite episode of this podcast was, and I couldn't do that either. I like them all.
It wasn't mine. It wasn't one of mine.
Of course. It was all four. This, I believe, is your fourth appearance on the show. So obviously it's the Michael Fremmer episodes.
It's like Steve Martin on Saturday Night Live, you know?
Right, you yeah.
Episodes, you join the club. Let's start a club,
yes. Well, what would you say was the... I mean, I guess you'd probably say the Andrew Jones would be the best sound, but best budget sound.
Yeah, that's a stupidly good system for about $600. I mean, it really is. And it's got a good moving magnet phono preamp built into it. So I reviewed that on my website with a VPI Traveler turntable that costs more than the whole system. But if you could take that with a Project Carbon and a moderately priced CD player and be done for a long time. If you're, you know, strapped for cash.
Yeah, yeah.
And music's important to you.
Somebody, a Midnight Rider in the chat room, is asking, not about the show, but something that will probably take another whole episode. I'll just mention it to you now so you can think about it, although I'm sure you've got a lot to say, more than we have time for right now. Which do you prefer, tubes or solid state?
You know, that's a really good question, and I'm about to answer. Well, it doesn't matter what I like personally, but I'm about to talk about this in a review I'm doing of the Lam ML3 amplifiers. They're only $150,000 for a pair.
Tube-based.
Tube-based. It's all tubes. There are like 7 or 8 rectifier tubes across the front of the power supply. Power supply is in a separate box. That's a 4-box amplifier. So there's a giant power supply box that's got a row of rectifier tubes. I think they're rectifier tubes in front. And then there's another box that's got this one giant transmitter tube that produces all the amplification. It produces 30 watts of single-ended power. And by any definition, it's spectacular sounding. And it's among the best amplifiers I've ever heard. I'm not supposed to talk about what I'm going to say in a review, but
just briefly.
I'll use the fact that I got off a plane a few hours ago and I'm tired, isn't it? Anyway, it's got this sense of continuousness. It's got all the qualities that tubes have that people say solid state doesn't have, that they prefer. It also has great extension on bottom. It has decent bass and it's got good extension on top. Very open high frequencies. And yet,
but with only 30 watts, you'd need pretty high efficiency speakers, would you not?
Yeah. Well, the Wilson XLFs are very efficient and I can blow my ears out in my room with this 30 watts. No problem. But for listening to music, you know, strings, you just can't beat these amps for listening to violins and strings and acoustic music. But if you want to rock out, that's not the amp you'd want to choose. You'd want a solid state amp. And the solid state amp has some other qualities that I prefer and certain qualities that I don't prefer. So I don't prefer either. They're different. There are tube people that swear by tubes and there are solid state people that swear by solid states amps. And I'm agnostic on the subject. They both have great qualities. So I own solid state amps and I also own a tube amp. I own a Music Reference RM200, which is a $4,500 tube amp. It's 100 watts per channel. It's a hybrid amp with a JFET front end and a push-pull KT88 or 6550 output, fully balanced, and $4,500. To me, when I reviewed it, I said, if you think this is expensive, you're in the wrong hobby. And boy, did I take a lot of crap. But seriously, if you're in a high-performance audio hobby, $4,500 for an incredibly great, it measured great, it sounds great, it'll drive a lot of speakers. That's not a lot of money for what you get. In my opinion.
Just for everybody to make sure we understand, a JFET front end is a transistor or solid state front end.
That's right.
And a tube-based back end, which makes sense because in tube amps, it's the tubes themselves that are actually doing the amplification.
Right. That's right. Yeah. And it's a great product. So I have that, and that'll drive the big speakers very, very well. And I have a solid state amp for all the rest of the time, and I can pop them back and forth whenever I need to.
Yeah,
so,
cool.
Which is better? I can't, they're both great. Which do I prefer? Who cares who cares what I like? The people who care what I like really should think twice. What I like doesn't matter. What you like is what matters. I don't try to frame a review. You know, it's like when you go to a restaurant and you say, tell me about the specials. They go, well, I personally like the, hey, I don't care what you like. Guess what? You're the waiter. That's the latest thing, that's what they do in restaurants though. It didn't happen 10 years ago. Now it's like, well, I think the is particular. I like the, well, good for you. Well, you go eat it. I don't want to not care what you like. I care what I like. I hope when I write a review, when you finish reading it, you'll decide whether maybe you'd like it, And maybe I'll put at the end of the review, for me, it's not what I like, but I may not do that. It's just, it doesn't matter what I like.
Right. Right. Okay. Last couple minutes of the show, we saw video in a couple of rooms. Did you pay any attention to that at all?
I went in to see the Wolf big projector, the big 4K projection system.
Well, it's a rebranded JVC with pseudo 4K, what they call E-Shift.
Don't say that. You're not supposed to say
Hey, I'm supposed to bring the truth to the people here, man.
So it's not a 4, it's not a 4K projector?
It's not a true 4K projector. It won't accept a 4K signal. It will up-convert 1080p to pseudo 2160p by shifting the pixels around. You know, it's a good first step and everything.
So what is the Sony's got a true 4K though, right?
They do. Yep, they do. And now we're seeing a number of a true 4K or really 2160p flat panels, including the one that was in the Totem Acoustics room at the show. They had the 84-inch LG,
right,
which they weren't, you know, showing true 4K because there isn't any, essentially.
Right.
They were just upscaling. And it looked pretty good. I must say I wasn't very impressed with the Totem Acoustics sound. They had some new speakers in there. Tribe on walls with some very narrow, shallow, dual 8-inch subwoofers. And I can't say I really liked the sound that much. I liked the sound in the Wolf room. It was actually put on by Source AV, a retailer.
Right.
They had Sonus Faber Venere speakers.
I reviewed those, actually.
Oh, yeah? What'd you think?
Well, you know, I liked them. I wrote that they voiced them for a younger generation that likes a little bit more high-frequency response.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't hear what they meant. The measurements, if you looked at the measurements, you'd never buy them. The measurement was like, at the upper frequencies, there was like a Mount Everest. I mean, there was just like this wall. It went all the way up, like at 8K, all of a sudden, it shot up. It was frightening. But then there was a trough in the upper mid-range, which translated to really pleasant sound, because most film tracks are bright and hard and unpleasant, in my opinion. They're all heavily processed. So when you put all the speaker together, they were not expensive. They were stylish. And I thought they sounded great. The guy that did the measurements was appalled that I liked them, because there are some people that are led around by their nose by the measurements.
Right. Which is only part of the story.
Exactly. You have to listen, ultimately.
Exactly right. Well, listen, thank you so much for being here, taking an hour out of your day, especially after surviving a red-eye flight back from L.A. All night last night. Michael Fremmer, thanks so much.
Nice to be with you. Thank you, Scott.
So you can reach Michael and read all his stuff, and he is very prolific at analogplanet.com. You can find me, of course, at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. You can also find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here on the Twit Network, twit.tv/htg. And on our YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Jude Mansilla, the editor of headfi.org, and we're going to be talking about earbuds and other things related to headphones, which should be absolutely fascinating, and I do hope you will join me. Until then, geek out.